Well, everybody, welcome to Flowing Sales Podcast again. We are honored to have Dr. Tolbert with us, and he's done some really interesting research. I was recently at PTRA, heard some of his stuff on a panel, and he gave a talk there that maybe we can get into here that's really interesting. And so maybe I'll just turn it over to you for a second to give a brief introduction, some of the stuff you've researched and things like that, and that'll tee us off here.
Yeah, awesome. All right. So after the U.S. Navy, I was in the Navy for several years. I got into manufacturing. Primarily, I worked for Union Carbide. And then I went to work for Birmingham Steel. And I worked for Kennametal making cutting tools. So I did a lot of the material science and the material manufacturing, advanced products. Because of U.S. Steel, I got involved with automation, motors, drives, and distributing. I worked for a company called Automation Direct for a few years, where I was a tech support application engineer. Then later I got into product engineering. And then that led to industrial distributor that I worked for about 20 years and became the vice president of engineering for. I left there recently in the 22 to come all the way to South Dakota, where I work now for Molloy Electric as a senior application engineer. Along the way, I've been collected probably 30 certifications and 2 bachelor's, 2 master's and a PhD and a post-grad economics. So I've been really good at taking tests, as they say.
That's awesome. There's not a lot of, it puts you in a unique position, I think, that you've done all of those things and you've seen so much in the manufacturing world. Can you tell us a little bit about your dissertation and kind of what you went into there? And I think it's pretty fascinating.
Yeah. So I get questions like, why did I study like organizational behavior coming from a math and engineering and physics world? And what it is human behavior is far more difficult than math. I mean, it's really difficult. And one of my aspirations was to try to understand how decisions are made, from a humanistic perspective, and then translate that into software and automation, right? So that's kind of was one of my overarching goals. Now, what happened was I got an idea of like, okay, well, how can I study the fitness of an organization, the survivability of an organization from a qualitative perspective, through the people, through the lived experience? I think that was a missing piece in the academic literature. And it turned out that I used industrial distribution where I was working as a backdrop of that. And that became like the first research of industrial distribution like it in like 50 years. Like I mentioned in the talk, most of the industrial distribution research is wholesale distribution, logistics, online sales, inventory management, supply chain. It's not the lived experience, the qualitative piece, the leadership, the survivability, if you will. I mean, none of that has really kind of been touched in many, many years.
What are some of the things that came out of that were maybe surprising or maybe useful, right? I mean, to your point, no one had studied this from a really rigorous standpoint, right? So what stood out?
I broke the research into 3 different groups: industrial distribution leaders, rep agents, and brand representatives, the people that actually work for the factories. And the perspectives I got were really interesting because it's the interaction between the 3 groups that make up industrial distribution. And the distance to the customer is a huge part of that. And what I mean by that is, okay, so if you have a distributor, you have about 1,500 products and you're closest to the customer, right? And rep agents are like the next level out and they only have about 15 products. Well, most manufacturers, they want to get closer to the customer because that's where they have a deficit of information. Like, where's my products go after the sale? So they are the farthest away, but they're all trying to get closer. So that's where you get the ideas of point of sale reports, POS, you have minimally advertised pricing policies. You have several other things that manufacturers have instituted in a way to get that data as a means to understand where their products go and get closer to the customers. Again, that was a fascinating detail that really wasn't found in any of the research. The other key one was the idea of taking blame. So rep agents being in the middle, they felt that one of their big responsibilities was to take blame for both the distributor and the brand. So if something happened, they were like, hey, stand on me, I'm going to make this right. And they wouldn't pass it upstream or downstream. So it was really a fascinating discussion there. And it gave them a sense of reverence, which made them feel important to the process. And not all brands use reps. A lot of times they have a direct sales force, so you don't get the same type of reverence nor the accountability. It is another fascinating detail.
They talked about at PTRA this idea of a rep council. You're mentoring in your first point, right? The manufacturers are furthest from the customer, but a lot of times they're trying to come up with maybe new products or iterations on a product. Like, that's really important information to have. So is maybe that the rep council idea one of the concepts that you can bridge the gap here?
Yeah. So I've been on part of several distributor councils for manufacturers over the years. And I always bring up the fact that if there are reps involved, because they're not always involved, they actually know where all the customers across all the distributors are. So distributors generally have one piece of the picture when it comes to a local market. Their reps, if they're there, generally have a more complete understanding because they see everything coming in their territory. And they have access to the manufacturers differently than distributors do, right? So I'm an avid advocate of that as well. And I even mentioned that during the panel. So I think it's a really good idea, actually.
Yeah. How many people do you think do those? Is it pretty widespread or is it not so common?
They come and go. So what happens with brands, this is another thing came out of the research, is the larger the manufacturer, the more likely the turnover of leadership is. So that's a big challenge, is every 2 to 4 years, there's a new leader of the channel management part of the brand that deals with reps and manufacturers. Generally, every 10 years, the manufacturer often gets in their mind that, hey, you know what, we can do this better than a rep. So often you hear the tales of reps getting fired because of the new leader comes on board looking for a home run, right? So it's the same cadence, like for people wanting to have some type of customer council, distributor council, rep council, as far as getting that feedback. I think it's a good idea, even from a distributor perspective, to have a customer council to actually help drive them to be better. I think it's a good part of the survivability feedback that's often missing. I don't think it's done quite enough.
So we're a manufacturer's representative in out of Raleigh, North Carolina. So we've been on a lot of these rep councils over the years. They do have cycles for the most part. There's a few that have been year in, year out. You know, we're going to have those, and they're always beneficial. To me, it's important to have these just from a rep's perspective, so we can have those conversations about, okay, where's the manufacturer going? What markets are they getting into? What new products? And where are we heading as a team? Because at the end of the day, we're in this together. So we all got to have eyes down the road on where we're all heading collectively. And then the other part was, you talked about a customer council. We've got one manufacturer that does an excellent job with this. They bring in some of their key customers every year, and they talk about, where are your problem areas? Like, what could we design and build for you that would eliminate an issue for you? And that's how they go to market. And they build products that just really fit an issue. And it's all feedback. I mean, at the end of the day, this isn't rocket science. Let's go ask the people we're going to sell to what they need. But what you think is basic is not very basic out there. A lot of times somebody's sitting in a corner office just designing something versus asking the people that are supposed to buy it, what do you need? So yeah, it's interesting to hear your take on it as well.
Well, you know, it's the biggest product design failure ever with, you know, Cayman's Segway. Right. You know, a perfect example of that, he designed it in the vacuum without a customer base. Right. So no value proposition was created in any way, shape or form. And then all of a sudden you're left with something that all this investment went into that really had no market. So that's always kind of like a cautionary tale for product development, which I've done tons of product development in my past. And it's always, okay, identify the pains and gains and try to answer those questions through development, which includes personas, you know, people, what they want there. So there's a whole subcategory there of creating personas, which is part of my current research, what I'm doing right now. So it's a good segue into that, no pun intended.
Yeah, right, the segue. Well, let's talk, is that in line with some of the AI stuff you were talking about?
Yeah, exactly, 100%. So as part of the research I did in 22, I became an expert in what they call hermeneutic phenomenological research. So hermeneutic phenomenological research. And all that means is it's the lived experience, but it's a process of hermeneutics where you kind of embrace the bias differently. When you do qualitative research, there's like two versions. One is like the guy in the white coat looking behind the mirror, trying to be an objective observer where you're describing what you're seeing, right? Hermeneutic just means that you're part of the research where it's interpretive, right? And that comes from a guy named Gadamer and then Heidegger, the German process that when qualitative research was kind of developed, not to get too deep into that. But the bottom line is that the process you go through is called a hermeneutic circle, and you create horizons, which are basically like arguably prejudices. It allows you to create a persona of people, right? And that's really, if you think about AI and the sales process piece, so you're trying to teach a voice because AI is nothing but pattern recognition. So you, if you have the better model and a better process of creating the model to teach the AI, then your end product is significantly better. And that's why, you know, I think you and I talked, the resolution issue of teaching is also the challenge. So really what I'm focusing is a new version of getting better resolution for the user to teach AI. And I'm using hermeneutics to do that because it's a very unique process to its own merits. So that's my current research. I know it's a little out there, but it's when I finalize it, it'll make sense.
It's interesting. Can you give us maybe just an example of, you know, you mentioned using like, I'm going to use the example of a CRM and I'm going to train the AI to say a certain message. Can you just take us through an example of that?
Yeah, sure. So just briefly, so everything's kind of based on open AI, you know, really is the baseline. Of course, you have what's a GPT 4.0 or 3.0. And what I found is like all of these companies like AnyWord or Jasper or, you know, any of the bigger ones, like, you know, what used to be called Bard. I forget what Google calls it now. It's another company that's no longer Bard. But so there's like a subgenre of AI companies that do like content, right, as a specialty. And that's the Jaspers, the AnyWords of the world. And what you do is you can teach a brand voice of your process. And then you have customer personas or targets. And the idea is that you basically these become prompts. You know, we're all familiar with prompts and AI. So you're basically taking hermeneutic, like an essay almost, and you're going through line by line of all the pains and gains created from this fusion that you create from hermeneutics. And then you're basically using that to install into these models, either as the brand voice or as the end user target. If I'm writing marketing copy. Again, you can do it two ways. I'm focusing primarily on the target customer. So if I'm trying to use industrial distribution, my 2 years of research on that topic, and I already created the fusion of horizons, which is the persona, I'm teaching that, but I have to use, like, if I'm going to test the software, I have to use the same, all the variables have to be, I have to change everything to constants and just have one variable to test, if you will. As far as an hypothesis. Again, I know it's a little out there, but.
I mean, along with that, I think there's a lot of practical application there, right? That can help firms or distributors or manufacturers, maybe to your point, write better copy or even better understand the customer, things like that. What are some of the applications that you see and that it's used for?
Well, that's a good question, right? There's got to be a split here, right? So one is academics. But just like plagiarism checkers, there's now AI checkers, and I've tested several of them, and they're very, very good. So they can actually determine how human your writing is, believe it or not. So just like plagiarism checking, generally academics, they want you under like 10% plagiarism for an article. Because a lot of times you get quotes, you get things that, you know, are so common, you can't get rid of them. So, you know, just to be unique. Well, the same thing for AI now. So I've done a couple consulting things for academics where I'm looking at pieces. So I run them independently through an AI checker, and it's shocking to see 80% written by AI as an academic submitting it for publication. If you even believe that. So what's happening is the technology is so new. Some people are using it as a kind of a crutch to fulfill some things, then it's really a bad thing. Now, universities and schools are going to have to really get used to checking for AI content. And it's interesting because the pattern recognition will detect, because it all arises from kind of the same source through OpenAI. So you can actually tell if it's AI written or not. They also have tools that fit on your browser that can actually look at copy and web stuff and other things to see if it's AI generated. Now, the practical application is just like you're saying with email sales stuff or marketing campaigns, email campaigns, you know, writing scripts. Actually, I think AI works very well if you're writing scripts for other types of media that's outside of writing. I think that's kind of fascinating too, because I think somebody did a test. I heard of somebody writing like valedictorian speeches through AI, and they sounded amazing. They wrote four or five different speeches, and the verbalization of that made it awesome, right? But if you read it or published it, you might be able to detect that it was AI generated, because I think we're all getting more attuned to that. It's like the wolves and the moose, you know, it's the predator prey model of, okay, AI gets better, less recognizable, but we get more in tune to recognizing AI generated content. I can tell for the most part now after working with this stuff for about a year.
But to your point, if it writes a speech and then someone gives the speech, it's another step away from AI, right?
Yeah, because you're humanizing the speech through the process of giving it. So it's the interpretation and then the replay, right? So it's not quite an imitation. So in the written word, however, it's harder to mask that unless you internalize and rewrite it explicitly. And this is why I tell people who are like, well, Carl, if I use AI, I said, well, use it to summarize, use it for other areas of collecting data as an assistant to you as an academic. But when you go to write it, you have to basically internalize it and then put it back out through synthesis, right? And that's really the key point from an academic perspective. And eventually, all of us, even marketing, are going to have to start doing the same thing because it'll be so recognizable. And do we have the stigma from our users to say, hey, you're using AI-generated content because you're lazy or you're not creative, right? So how is that going to eventually look? Not now because it's so new, but within 5 years.
Yeah. Do you see a lot of adoption, like in the manufacturing, distributor, rep circles? Do you see, how much adoption do you see of AI versus how much opportunity is there?
What I've seen right now is I've seen some engineering folks use it as like, as a crutch, saying, all right, well, how do I calculate torque for an electric motor? You know, it throws up the formula. So it's like a fast way of saying, hey, here's the data, here's the calculation. But the problem, just like when you use it to create like regular content based on keywords or something, or you're teaching it from different documents that you feel like a tone you want to get for your brand, it may get it wrong, right? And this is the challenge, is that if you're using it and you're not double checking it as a human, AI knows no difference. So if the pattern is X, it may go down the wrong path because of something that it has a reference for, but it's the wrong type of reference, right? So I've seen that too. I've seen errors created. And if you base your engineering or your critical designs on AI stuff and don't double check it, then you have a problem potentially. That's what I've seen as well. So there is a risk there.
Yeah. So hallucinating, right? Just kind of make stuff up and sometimes sounds very authoritative.
Oh, yeah. And it's fascinating. Even some of the guys that created OpenAI, this is some of the stuff that they really safeguard about, right? So it's like I have ChatGPT and I ask it, well, how do you develop a bomb? You know, say I want to add gunpowder or I want to create explosives. It really won't help you because there's keywords that you have safeguards already. And that goes to kind of like some of the ethical parts of AI. I think several years ago, I worked on a lot of research of ethics in AI. I don't think there's an overarching theme yet, but eventually there will be some type of ethical framework because it's going to be a necessity. I mean, it's already part of our lives and everything we do. I mean, look at the AI used for traffic navigation from like Google Maps, you know, those kind of things are already there that you don't even know is there. I think when people start talking about that, we'll never see consciousness. You know, that's the other part of AI that people get scared about, is the Terminator, you know, all that stuff. And it's really unfounded. They should have no worries about that because, you know, pattern recognition is not consciousness. So, I mean, people put a lot of into that and it's really not true.
I think you hit an interesting point, is fear. Like when you talk about AI just to the masses, I think there is a certain element of fear, but I look at it from our business standpoint. I look at it as another tool in the toolbox to support us to do our job. I don't look at it as hey, I'm going to replace somebody or I'm going to replace this or that. It's a tool that our folks can use to be more efficient. It's a tool that we can utilize to make us better at what we do. And like you said, we can still humanize that, but also have that crutch, if you will, to lean on to get certain information to make us better at our job. So I don't think we should be fearful of it. I think we should be excited about it and how it can enhance what we're doing each day. And that's kind of what we've done with Flow. I mean, we look at that as that's the future, is we want to give tools through AI that are going to allow reps to do a better job for their manufacturers and customers.
Well, I think that, I mean, think about how far we've came with, like, you know, business, was it Microsoft's Power BI, or, you know, they were the first ones that would create graphs based on a sentence. You remember what, so they were using like this AI engine to say, all right, if I need to look at how many sales are going, how many VFDs are sold in Tampa, Florida in the month of August, all your 10 years of data is consolidated into that particular question and giving you some kind of graph. I think that's amazing because all of a sudden big data now has the data that's hidden within big data is now easily unraveled by AI help. I think that's something we didn't have even a few years ago, right? So you had to get like some data scientists, you know, some R specialists to dig through all that data. And now you don't have to do that. It's vastly different. Things are changing. I think that's a huge part of this thing too, that we're going to enjoy, you know, from, you know, a CRM or just a business perspective over the next 5 years.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen, to your point, like even a year ago, some of the stuff that we're able to do now didn't even exist, right? So like for example, to your point, we can take product spec sheets, all these PDFs about a lot of these reps represent a lot of lines. That's a lot of complexity and warranties and this information, that information. They're trying to do a consultative sale to somebody and keep all this stuff in their minds. Well, AI is really good at that, right? It can look through all your documentation. And we've seen how you can ask a couple of intelligent questions against the right data set of your product lines to ensure it's not making things up. And it'll give you a really good, like, well, here's maybe some products you want to recommend, and here's how you want to package this. And, oh, I didn't think about that because there's so much information to keep on top of. So, and I think that's just going to keep going. I mean, what do you think? What do you see 5-10 years from now? You know, and especially with your research in, you know, survivability and maybe how AI works itself into the lived experience, right, of a rep firm or a distributor. Where do you see that going?
Yeah, that's really a great question. So one of the things that you touched on just a second ago was as reps also pick up diverse lines, right? This came up in a lot of discussions during the conference, is that, okay, if I'm a bearing and PT rep agent, but all of a sudden I'm picking up a servo line, what do I have to do differently? And then if you start seeing successes, then you start saying, okay, I'm succeeding with this higher tech line and these two other lines that I'm surprised to see have synergies, because you may not see it, but AI will, right? So that's part of the thing, is that with AI, you know, more machine learning, is that I'm looking for an hypothesis. I don't have one to test. I'm looking for one. So it's kind of a backwards process. And that's why sometimes you have to have such an open mind when you do machine learning in the first place. But to answer your question about the next 5 years, I think it's interesting. Independent reps have really their time is now to start making better relationships, because the bigger brands that have direct sales forces, they're kind of consolidating and they're moving away from the local marketplace. I think it's a huge opportunity for reps to start actually working more closely with their independents before, even more than they did previously. I think that's a shift, right? Brands will still continue to try to get closer to customers through phone apps and other means. There's all kinds of data. And eventually POS will be instituted across most industrial markets. And right now, if you sell, you know, automation products like Banner and Turk, POS is a standard process that you have that's not present in some other areas of distribution and rep relations, you know, brand relationships. All brands want that because it's data for them that they currently don't have. So I think there's a lot of that shifting going on. And then I think the technical piece is also shifting, because the thing is, you can't find easily high-tech individuals to fit sales positions at any level, whether you're a rep, brand, or distributor. So we're going to have to come up with some kind of idea about how to fill the workplace deficits of knowledge over the next 10 years. And that's a huge, huge question that every member of the panel brought up during those discussions, right?
Dan, what do you think, talking about the rep model specifically? Right. Yeah. I mean, you noted things are kind of shifting and changing. What are some ways you see, maybe with AI or the changes that you're seeing that are happening? How does the rep firm model, like, how do they stay relevant, or maybe not even relevant, but a step beyond that? How do they keep themselves irreplaceable, right, and super valuable to the system?
Well, I think for a lot of manufacturers, a lot of brands, if you do the math, it's really a cost thing. To have a direct employee, it's ridiculously expensive, right? And then the problem is you don't get the coverage, right? So if I'm a big brand and I want a direct representative on my payroll,
goal.
And it's cost me, I think the number came up was like 300 to 350,000 all in, and they're covering like five states. So you don't have the coverage ups that are really big opportunities, right? But if you have rep agents, generally you have groups that cover like one person per state or two people per state. You have a lot better coverage at a fraction of the cost. And the local people have, they know the local market, which you'll never know from a manufacturer's perspective easily, right? So I think from a pure economic perspective, reps are still very, very important. And every 10 years, you have that cycle of replacement that we kind of pinpointed through the interviews, through the subject interviews. But I think the other piece is the technical knowledge. I think that since reps only have a maximum of 15 brands, generally it's even less than that. Since they have a specific focus, they become subject matter experts faster than, say, a distributor who has 1,500 brands, right? So I think that's another piece. And of course, the focus of OEMs and bigger house accounts is huge too. One or both of you came from the electronics business, right? The wholesale business.
Yeah. Well, electrical, you know, we're in the utility electrical market.
Yeah. I think it was Brian Shirley that was electronic component guru. And I think it's that business is more about the spec, getting on the spec and where the distributors are more transactional. We still have some of that with industrial distribution, but it's the OEM piece that the brands have to have somebody covering explicitly, right? And you can't always count on distribution to do that and have that focus because OEMs are tough. It's high volume, but it's long gestation, slow pay. There's all these other challenges handling OEM businesses that distributors both like and dislike. So I think reps play a big part with the OEM business for brands as well that you can't quite get the same way with distributors.
What are you most excited about, right? I mean, you're doing research in AI, you're in this space. Like, what are you most excited about?
I think relationships within this business is unique. You know, because see, when I ask the question, I always ask it to anybody I meet, even the trainings I do, is like, how you got into this business? And with distribution, whether you're a rep or brand or a distributor, one third was random. One third was friends and family. And one third was like some kind of educational program. Internship, or you went to distribution program like Texas A&M or ECU or, you know, UAB, one of the universities that has an actual program. I think it's fascinating, but what keeps people here is actually the relationships, because everybody knows everybody. It's very incestuous, but in kind of a positive way, is if you're in this business, you rarely ever leave. I think that's curious too, right? So relationships, I'm curious to see how some things play out with some of these bigger brand acquisitions. And I'm curious to see, you know, I mentioned about e-commerce on my panel. I think if a distributor's in e-commerce and they're successful now, they're going to stick with it. But if they're not, then a lot of distributors are pulling the plug and just exiting because it can't get the traction or the focus on making e-commerce really a valued part of their business, right? So we're seeing an abandonment right now, which I think is interesting. So what's seeing, I really am curious about the MAP policies, right? Minimally advertised price. So you have it's that free rider problem I also talk about quite a bit. So there's two issues. If there's a free rider problem of, I did all the engineering, but the customer shot me around and bought it online for $5 cheaper, right? That's a first order free rider problem. The second order free rider problem is the manufacturer knows this is happening, but since they're still getting the sale, they really don't want to spend the money to enforce it, right? And that's a real thing, because everybody talks about in their contracts they have an enforcement mechanism, but the reality is it doesn't exist unless somebody complains. So most distributors have given up complaining that they have some online companies selling it cheaper online, but inevitably that's become more of a bigger problem as we get more mature within this part of the business being sold online even more than it is now. I think manufacturers are going to really have to contend with that. And lastly, the new non-compete rulings recently is going to change the way people have to retain their employees. I think that's actually very positive. Again, it's sometimes tension and conflict isn't good, but it's good for organizational fitness. It's good for survivability. So that tension that creates now everything has to shift again to focus on retention in the best way possible. So it's going to make organizations stronger. I truly believe that.
Yeah. Well, they talked a lot about PTRA. You know, one of the main points was, you know, people coming into the workforce, they're hopping jobs every 2, 3, 4 years. And so the turnover is just crazy to try to retain folks.
Yeah. Well, you know, actually in the software business, that's almost, they talk about portable, like benefit packages, where all of a sudden everybody has like the same benefit package. It doesn't matter what job they go to, because everybody jumps job every 2 to 3 years. In distribution, it's not quite the same. You know, you have some turnover with the younger generation now, but I think if the retention was there, the approach, the type of job, I think we would have better success. But I don't think anybody has the perfect formula yet, right? I think that's really something that's, I'm waiting to see kind of how that plays out. And since some of the crutches like the non-competes are gone, I know the Chamber of Commerce is going to like challenge it, but I think it's still going to come out for the individual freedom is really going to ring out on that one, I think.
Well, yeah, we appreciate you jumping on and just chatting with us. It's been, I didn't know we were going to get into AI today. I mean, yeah, that's something we do all the time. And, but that's awesome. All right. Well, thank you so much.
Hey, thank you.